It's a bit dark, isn't it? Yes, indeed, mes petits amis. This symphony is serious stuff. It's the work of Antonin Dvorak, and it's his 7th symphony. I'm WBJC's Jonathan Polevsky, and this is a Baltimore Symphony Orchestra podcast. When we think of Antonin Dvorak today, two things immediately come to mind. First, he wrote 9 excellent symphonies, and second, he represents the very essence of Czech music, and for that matter, Czech culture. Like so many things, it was not always so. When Dvorak published his 7th symphony, which was premiered in London at St. James Hall on April 22, 1885, he called it his 2nd. It was also his wish that this work contain a patriotic and nationalistic element. He wrote a friend, "I am now busy with this symphony for London, and wherever I go, I can think of nothing else. God grant that this Czech music will move the world." A few words on this extraordinary composer, with whom I share a birthday, are in order, before considering the numbering of his symphonies and the symphony itself. Dvorak's origins could not have been more humble. He was born in the small village of Nelohozeves, outside Prague, to a father who was an innkeeper, butcher, and amateur zither player. He was the oldest of 14, and probably destined for an excellent career in innkeeping and butchery. His father, however, noticed that he had musical talent and sent him off to his brother in the nearby town of Zlonice to study violin, organ, piano, and, most importantly, the German language. Dvorak moved to Prague at age 16 and for many years struggled as church organist, freelance violinist, and music teacher. The composer's big break happened in 1874 when the 33-year-old composer applied for and won the Austrian State Prize for Composition. The esteemed panel of judges for the award consisted of music critic Eduard Hanslick, the composer Johannes Brahms, and the director of the state opera, Johann Herbeck. Though unknown, Dvorak was prolific. According to the judges, he submitted 15 compositions, among them 2 symphonies, which display an undoubted talent. The applicant deserves a grant to ease his straitened circumstances and free him from anxiety in his creative work. And free him it did! All of a sudden, this fantastic influx of state funds enabled the composer to spend less time giving music lessons to ungrateful children and adults, spend less time playing the organ in churches, and not be obliged to play the violin in theater orchestras. Dvorak won the prize 2 more times, and it is no exaggeration to say that it completely changed his life. Brahms was particularly impressed with this Czech composer, who was 8 years his junior, and introduced him to his publisher, Fritz Simrock. More on him anon. Less than a decade later, Dvorak's Stabat Mater was performed in London and was adored by the English public. This led to the composer being commissioned by the London Philharmonic Society in 1884 to write a new symphony. Dvorak was thrilled to show the English what he was capable of doing in the symphonic genre and began working on the commission immediately. The work was completed and performed in about a year. At the time, Dvorak referred to this work as his 2nd symphony because it was only his 2nd to be published. The composer considered it his 6th symphony because his 1st was lost and not recovered until long after the composer's death. For a long period after Dvorak's death in 1904, only the composer's later symphonies were known and performed. Fortunately, since the 1960s, all of Dvorak's 9 wonderful symphonies are available in recordings and live performances. To the music, mes petits amis. The beginning of the symphony is dark. We are in the key of D minor, the key of such light classical favorites as Mozart's Requiem and Beethoven's 9th Symphony. After a low D pedal, the violas and cellos lead us through the darkness and into theme 1. Another reason to love Antonin Dvorak is that he loved trains. I do too. He also loved visiting train stations. I do too. He said that this first theme of the first movement flashed into my mind on the arrival of the festive train bringing our countrymen from Pest. The passengers were headed to the National Theater, where there would be a musical performance to support the emerging Czech national struggle. Back to the music. The serious mood continues as Dvorak immediately starts to fragment and develop his dark theme. Suddenly, the clouds clear and we are in a major key with some beautiful horn writing. Could this be our contrasting second theme? No, sadly not. As nice as this little themelet is and the seconds of contrast it provides, we return to the serious business of theme one in full orchestral strength. But this too breaks down after a few quiet moments, and we meet our actual second theme. It's just another example of the endless beautiful music that's spilled from the pen of one Antonín Dvořák. It has a dancey Czech folk feel about it. To wrap up the exposition of our themes, first we hear theme one, which starts out as dark and emerges triumphant. Theme 2 also sounds triumphant. Now that we've met Dvořák's two themes, it's time to develop them. We start with theme two. Note how unstable and anxious it sounds. Then we start to play with theme one. When Dvořák returns us to his themes after the development in the recapitulation, there is no missing it. Here's theme one. And here is lyrical theme two. The coda section, which ends the movement, contains lots of theme one, and this particular iteration, which uses the brass, is most passionate. The movement ends quietly and broodingly. Revolutions are not without their casualties and sadness. In the score of the second movement, Dvorak wrote From the Sad Years. When asked by a friend about the music, he said, "What is in my mind is love, God, and my fatherland." Without knowing more, we can only speculate. His mother had died 2 years before. He was also mourning the death of his eldest child, and the health of his friend and mentor, the composer Smetana, was deteriorating. We begin with a wistful melody on the clarinet that we'd all wish we'd written. We eventually wend our way into a new theme, which is an amazing dialogue between an alpine horn and a flute. On a personal note, this reminds me of the last movement of the First Symphony by Johannes Brahms. See what you think. Back to Dvorak. Suddenly, things get very stormy, as they can in the mountains, but just as quickly, they subside. Then we have some development of our alpine theme as Dvorak passes it around from instrument to instrument. The third melody in this movement is a beautiful hymn in the low strings. Toward the end of the movement, our opening melody returns, but this time on the melancholy oboe. Our movement, once again entitled Memory of the Sad Years, fades as memories do into silence. Traditionally, the third movements of symphonies are dances. For Mozart and Haydn, they were stately minuets. For Beethoven, the faster scherzo. Tchaikovsky used waltzes, Brahms something he called an intermezzo. Dvorak was no stranger to writing dances. One has only to think of his two sets of Slavonic dances, which are among his most popular works. Dvorak calls this movement a scherzo, but this is music that is far closer to the composer's Prague than to Beethoven's Vienna. The middle section of the movement is a bit more earthy, and also another example of Dvorak's incredible ease at writing music that is totally enjoyable to listen to. The final and fourth movement is like our first, written in sonata form. This is just the formal name for movements that have sections that allow us to meet our themes or expositions, places where we develop them, developments, and then the themes are recapitulated. There are three themes which concern us in this movement. Let's get to know them. Theme 1 begins with a spectacular octave leap up and returns us to the austere world of the D minor key. Theme 2 feels like it grew out of Theme 1 and even has that marvelous upward leap. It is very driven and very determined. By complete contrast, theme 3 is in the friendly key of A major and is redolent with sunlight and happiness. Here's just a bit of the development. Here, Dvorak uses a fragment of Theme 1 in a very misterioso way, almost like Halloween. Here's some fantastic fragmentation of theme 2 in the strings, with an extraordinary counter melody in the brass at the beginning. This symphony could very easily end on a tragic note and the key of D minor, but that wasn't Dvorak's temperament. While this is his darkest symphony by far, he refuses to leave us in the dark and ends in D major. mes petits amis, what is indeed great about Dvorak's Seventh Symphony? 1. Dvorak doesn't need a Mahler-sized orchestra to achieve great results. No tuba, no percussion other than timpani, and yet he plumbs the depths of emotion and orchestral color. 2. He uses standard forms to great effect. There's no smoke and mirrors here, no funny stuff. Dvorak's forms are conservative, and at the same time, his harmonies are innovative. 3. Fantastic thematic and melodic material. An old friend of mine, now long gone, said that Dvorak never wrote a minute of music that wasn't enjoyable to listen to. I agree. Dvorak is the musical composer you'd want to have a beer with. There is something human and humanizing about this piece and his music in general. 4. It's another great journey from the darkness of a minor key to the bright light of a major. However, unlike Beethoven, who strong-arms us through the process, Dvorak guides us. Epilogue. Once this piece was completed, Dvorak began the endless and annoying negotiations with his publisher, Simrock. Simrock said the title page must be in German only, refused to write Dvorak's full Czech name of Antonin on the score, preferring to use the German Anton, or just Ant, for short, and refused to print the dedication to the London Philharmonic Society. There was also the predictable squabble over money. Dvorak asked for an advance, saying, "I have a lot of expense with my garden, and my potato crop isn't very good." Simrock proposed the ridiculously small amount of 3,000 marks, about half the work's value. Dvorak demanded 6,000 and said that he had plenty of other publishers who were interested in the symphony. Simrock gave in. The work was a huge success from the get-go in 1885 and still delights audiences. It's worth quoting the review in the London journal Athenaeum. Dvorak's music is equally interesting and, we may add, satisfying to adherents of the conservative and the progressive schools of art. To the former, because it illustrates the fact that it is possible to create something entirely new and original without departing from the formal outlines or the canons of art laid down by the greatest masters of the past. To the more modern school, because of the boldness of his harmonic progressions and the freedom of his rhythmic combinations. Let's end with the great conductor and musical annotator Sir Donald Francis Tovey's thoughts on the matter. In my mind, he sounds just like this. "I have no hesitation in setting Dvorak's Seventh Symphony along with the great C major symphony of Schubert and the four symphonies of Brahms as among the greatest and purest examples of this art form since Beethoven." That's good enough for moi, mes petits amis. I'm WBJC's Jonathan Pilewski, and this has been a Baltimore Symphony Orchestra podcast for Antonín Dvořák's Symphony No. 7.